welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A little bit later in the show, we'll have our monthly philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. Last month, Jack and I got it wrong. We erred when we were talking about the origins of the term devil's advocate. Now, what should we do? Jack helps us find our way. And we begin today's show with our continuing conversation about Measure 4. This is the ballot question when all of us here in North Dakota will be asked whether we want to eliminate valuation-based property taxes, and what are the ramifications if we do? Aaron Burst, the executive director from the North Dakota Association of Counties, joins me as my guest. Aaron, welcome to Main Street.
Hey, thanks for having me, Craig. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Let me give our listeners a little bit of your background. You were born and raised in Bismarck. You went to school at NDSU and then to UND Law School. Who do you root for, by the way?
Yeah, that's always a tough one. And actually, even worse than that, I've got a son who's at NDSU and a son at UND. So
Wow. It
makes the Thanksgiving days a little more interesting.
I'll bet it does. He worked as a prosecutor in Cass County and then joined the North Dakota Association of Counties in 2006. And here we are today. He is the executive director. Aaron, we're pleased that you are with us. All right, Measure 4. You oppose it. Why?
Yeah, we do. Well, for a number of reasons. Largely, we feel that if you remove the taxing mechanism from the political subdivisions, which we relied largely on property taxes to pay for our budgets, that will cause significant disruption in how we fund our services. And so that's the main concern, that there's really no plan to replace that. This measure just ends property taxes. It does pay for that property that's been levied on in 2024. But going forward, there really would need be no plan, and that would require legislative action. And our members are very nervous about that.
The idea might be, okay, you're correct. However, there's some pork in the state's budget. We can cut to support this, and that money then can be used to reimburse from those 2024 levels in the future. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can always, you know, one person's pork is somebody else's necessity. So, I mean, you can always look for ways to save money. So nobody disagrees with that. But when you're talking about local government, really, in my opinion, that's the most essential services that you can have. Fire, EMS, prosecution, deputies. And so if you're relying on the state to have to find other avenues of cuts or tax increases, that would just put another layer of bureaucracy between the essential services and those who are trying to fund it. So that in our opinion, and we do have a couple of members who do support this, but the vast majority of county officials do not support changing the system, at least not changing the system without knowing what the alternative is.
What do you say to listeners who might be thinking this, and you've heard the argument before? I bought my home years ago for $160,000, and I loved my home a lot, but now they're telling me my home's worth $400,000. And I'm getting taxed on that, and I can't afford to stay in my own house anymore. What would you tell those folks in relationship to this ballot question?
Yeah, Craig, I'm a homeowner too, and my taxes have gone up. And what I would say on that is I think there are ways we could look at trying to address some of those dramatic increases. If somebody thinks their taxes will remain the same for the rest of their life, I think that's unrealistic. Services always end up costing more. There's always inflation. And so I think there are ways to address that. The legislature has tried to address that. As you know, they gave that $500 property tax credit that will be on everybody's bill. They've taken over county social services, which was a 20 mil reduction. So I understand where people get frustrated if their bills are going up. But at the end of the day, you're still paying for local service when you're talking about property taxes. And the data actually shows very few times are people actually kicked out of their house for not paying taxes. That's the last thing a county government wants to do, or any government for that matter. The better way to deal with those things are through some homestead tax exemptions and those kind of things, as opposed to just blowing up the whole system and trying to figure out how to deal with it later.
Our listeners are aware that I came from Wyoming, where I got to work with members of the Wyoming legislature. Last session, they had this proposal. You know what? Property taxes in Wyoming are also too high. And I think they were generally talking about Teton County in particular, which is an incredibly expensive county to live in. But let's do this. Let's eliminate property taxes, and then we'll just assess a 2% additional sales tax. That way, A, one third of that will be paid by out-of-state visitors to our state, Wyoming, and B, people can choose then whether to buy something or not. They don't, they're not held at the, I guess, hostage, so to speak, to the county assessor. Why not do that here?
Yeah, that's a great question, and something that I've been trying to think about and the legislature has been thinking about. And quite frankly, if anybody says they know the absolute right way to tax for services, including myself, they're full of it. Taxation policy is very difficult, and you can debate whether income tax or sales tax, we call, you know, a use tax. We can debate what tax is the absolute best, and it depends on who you talk to. If you looked at some of the policy wonks, in fact, the Tax Foundation just testified at the legislature, they are suggesting property taxes are the most efficient way to raise revenue and not hurt economic development. So you really have to have a balance. And North Dakota has always kind of had a fairly good balance. It used to be called the three-legged stool. It was sales tax, income tax, and property tax. And those were the three mechanisms to tax people, with the theory being the broader the base, the more you spread the taxation out for those services. In the last few years, of course, thanks to oil, we now have a fourth stool, which is the oil tax. And so we have four legs to that stool, but the legislature has, and I think that's been very positive, the legislature and the governor's office has reduced income tax. So we're basically back to a three-leg stool, and I understand why people would be mad at property taxes, but you need to keep a multiple legs to the stool so not one industry ends up taking it in the short. So that's my argument. Could you reduce property taxes and have a higher sales tax or income tax? Sure, you certainly could, but there's definitely negatives to that. You're going to disincentivize investment in economic development, and so there's definitely pros and cons of that too.
You've heard the arguments too that, oh my goodness, the state's legacy fund just is spilling over with money. Come on, start spending some of that stuff and give us property tax relief. How do you respond to that, Aaron?
Yeah, a couple of things. First off, again, thank God for oil. We are blessed with so many resources because of the oil activity. And quite frankly, we wouldn't even be having this debate if it wasn't for oil. My suggestion is if the legislature or the state was in essence broke or not having any money to distribute, nobody would really be complaining about their property tax because they realize they need those services. The in the weeds part for the legacy fund, yeah, the legacy fund will be sitting at about $11 billion this year. But that was a constitutional measure passed by the voters. And the legislature just can't raid that. They can raid up to 15% of the principal and the interest, depending on the two-thirds necessary. So you don't have access to that complete fund. And so even if you would, you know, we're talking about a $3 billion property tax shift to the state, and you would deplete that fund within a couple of years. So it's not as easy to just say, hey, the legacy fund is there, let's spend it. There's a lot of restrictions that the voters have placed on that fund.
Some would argue, well, the state could do more to offer property tax relief. Why haven't they done that already? Why haven't they gotten our message that property taxes are too high?
Yeah, I think if you asked a lot of legislators, they would be saying we have done a lot to offset those. And quite frankly, people's taxes would be a lot higher if they didn't do some of the things that they have done. Like I mentioned, social services was 20 mils right off the bat. That's 100 million. They've done a number a couple of years ago. They just bought down 12% of people's property taxes. They reversed course and they didn't like the way that mechanism was operating. But the legislature has done quite a bit. Now, you could say they haven't done enough, and I suppose we could argue that, but if you're sitting in a legislator spot, you have to be conservative too. You don't want to make a bunch of checks to pay off people's property taxes only to have oil crash or the economy crash, and now you're set having to raise people's taxes too. So it is very difficult balance. They are in tough positions. I'm almost positive they're looking for other ways to try to help property tax. But it's not as easy as just turning on the faucet and paying down taxes.
We're enjoying our conversation with Aaron Burse. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Association of Counties. We're talking about Measure 4. That's the measure that will be on this November's ballot, which potentially could eliminate property taxes in North Dakota, but certainly would have some ramifications on a lot of the ways we receive services in the state. Proponents of this say, we won't lose any services. Our services will be the same. What do you think about that?
Well, you would hope that to be true, but obviously services take money, and you have to find the money. Now, of course, what the measure does, and I want to make crystal clear, it does require the legislature to backfill all the property tax expenditures that were levied this year in 2024. So that would be covered. But again, there is no government that can operate, whether it's a local government, state government, federal government, that can just absolutely stay zero. As years pass, gas goes up for the sheriff's deputies' vehicles, or health insurance goes up for the employees, and you have to provide that or you won't have employees. And so there's always going to be an increased need for money. Now, you can debate how much that increase is, but it would be almost impossible to have a zero growth budget. So now the question becomes, where do you get that extra after the year 2025, 26, 27, 28? Where would you get that extra? And if the legislature wouldn't come up with more money or wouldn't come up with a new taxing mechanism, there would be a question of how you fund those operations going forward. Now, again, I would hope, and I think the supporters would say, nobody's going to be happy with losing street cleaning and snow plowing. So somebody will come up with a solution. But when you are fundamentally changing the tax system that we have in North Dakota, I think it's totally logical to ask hard questions on where is that coming from. And until we get the answers to that, the people I represent aren't comfortable with the direction we're going.
Heard the argument, and I disagree with it, that, hey, renters are getting a free ride. I'm a homeowner. Aaron, you're a homeowner. We're paying their way. I believe that a renter's rent has that baked in. What would you respond to, though, those people who are saying, hey, let's get on a level playing field with those who choose to rent?
Yeah, that's difficult. A lot of people who rent are maybe not having enough money to buy their own home. They are paying high rent rates. And again, the property tax of that landowner who owns the apartment complex is paying a healthy share of property tax, too. But again, they can pass that cost on to the renter. So trying to figure out who the winners and losers are on any system is always difficult. I think for the most part, everybody in North Dakota is paying a good share to make sure government operates correctly. And quite frankly, that's good. We want our citizens to have some skin in the game so they can decide what kind of services they want.
I'm paraphrasing the governor's comments here that he made at the Main Street event in Minot a few weeks ago. But essentially, he said, hey, look, if you want Bismarck and Fargo to benefit, vote for this, because they're gonna essentially benefit from this the most. You rural people are not. And I thought about that, and it's like, well, if I own a home in Fargo and you own a home in Bismarck and somebody else owns a home on the prairie somewhere, we're all getting a tax break, essentially. What are your thoughts about those types of comments that, hey, only the urban areas would benefit?
Well, I mean, everybody, if the measure would pass, which I hope it doesn't, but if it does pass, everybody would get a benefit from it because anybody who owns property, I should say, would get a benefit from it. I do think a large contingent of those who are upset at property taxes do tend to be in the urban areas where there's explosive growth. The Bismarcks, the Fargos, the Minots, they have had extreme growth scenarios, which is good. Growth is good for an economy. That shows things are healthy. But then, of course, values go up, and then that could lead to higher taxes, which it shouldn't necessarily, but I totally admit it does. The rural areas that aren't seeing that kind of explosive growth, their taxes have been more stable when we look at them. There are some differences between urban and rural when we're talking about this property tax, but quite frankly, if I look at it as the rurals would have more to lose because the large jurisdictions, let's say they do impose a sales tax. Sales tax works for large jurisdictions that have a lot of activity. A Sioux County couldn't have a sales tax to backfill any of that new necessary funding. there's just not enough economic activity to do it. Quite frankly, the large jurisdictions, people from Sioux County come over to Burley County and Bismarck here and do the shopping. So is that right that they spend their money and Burley County would be able to get that sales tax revenue? There's just so many different questions when you have these kind of radical kind of changes.
I want to circle back to some more comments the governor made in his Main Street Summit. Here's the summary. He criticized local governments for poor decisions that drive property taxes higher despite state-provided relief that you had talked about. And the quote was, if you keep subsidizing bad decisions locally, they'll keep happening. Again, if this measure does not pass, what's our responsibility to change then property taxes at the local level from the county's opinion?
Yeah, and I have a ton of respect for the governor. And whether those are bad decisions or not that were made by the locals have the right to make that decision. If the citizens don't like it, they can do something about it, namely go to the ballot box. I think what the governor, and there's some frustration in the legislature too, they have provided a lot of tax offsets to local government, and yet local government, their budgets do grow. I think that's a legitimate talking point. You can argue whether or not, building more roads out to subdivisions is a good use of money or not, but there is a frustration. I do think, clearly we're against Measure 4, but I do think we do have an obligation to try to look for other ways, because even if this goes down 20 or 30 percentage points, that's still a significant amount of people who would like us to take a different look of how we tax. But again, the devil's in the details. What kind of tax would you prefer as opposed to property tax?
So what is the county's then responsibility, Mr. Executive Director of the North Dakota Association of Counties, to bring those efforts forward to really have an impact on the property taxes we pay sooner rather than later?
Well, I think we got to be at the table on the county side. And I talk generally counties because counties are the ones that assess the property tax and collect the property tax. But the reality is counties are only about a 20% use of the property tax. Schools are 40 to 60. Cities are 20 to 30. Generally, I think all of those political subdivisions do have to have some sit-down conversations with policymakers and determine whether or not you could lower taxes or find a different mechanism. I've been chasing around the state for a while, for the last 20 years, talking to people about property taxes, and everybody has idea on property taxes, but then there's also negatives to some of those ideas. To try to thread that needle has been very difficult. And I do agree, some of the supporters of Measure 4 said, hey, in 2012, when this went down, the locals said, we got to find a better way. And I don't know if we found that better way. It's been whatever, 12 years, but that better way is not easy to find. And quite frankly, if you look at North Dakota's property tax, we're mid-level with the other states. When you look at Minnesota's property tax compared to North Dakota's, it's a no-brainer. The great state of Texas that you think is a lot of people think is a conservative state, their property taxes are higher than North Dakota's. So I don't think North Dakota is outrageous in their property tax. Could we do better? Yeah. Could we find a different way to fund some things? Sure. But I think we have to come to the table. 100% agree with that.
Both sides in this discussion have said the other side is just piling on the misinformation, the disinformation. And so listen to me, don't listen to them. From your perspective, what is the largest, I guess, most important pieces of disinformation we're hearing that is just a myth?
Well, these things can get debated. I hope they never get personal or anything like that. But again, I think the burden is on, if you're going to fundamentally change how you tax people, the burden should be on those that are suggesting the change of how they're going to answer some of the concerns. And I think raising concerns on major public policy issues is not, red herrings or scare tactics. It's a legitimate conversation to have. Probably one of the bigger misinformations that I've heard, and it's not an intentional, but if they said the legislature can come in and solve all of these more technical issues in a few bills, there's just no way that's possible. And let me just give you a primary example. The investment-owned utilities pay property taxes in the cities, primarily where they're providing services. The rural electrics don't pay property taxes, but they pay an in lieu of property tax, such as a transmission tax. Well, if you drop property tax from the IOUs, there's an unfair competitive advantage. That would have to be slugged out. And that is just one of at least 1,000 different scenarios that the legislature would have to figure out. And those are not easy answers. How would you then give the RECs the same competitive advantage? Those are very difficult questions. So you can't just flip the switch and say everything will be taken care of in the next legislative session. This would be a quite extensive process and litigation. There certainly would be litigation on people feeling whether they were treated better or worse or whatnot. So this is not easy stuff. If it was easy, we would have solved these kind of taxation issues generations ago.
Across the whole country.
Correct.
The proponents of this measure gave us information on where folks should go to get more information. As an opponent, where should we go to get more information about this Measure 4 property tax question?
Yeah, I mean, there is a group called Keep It Local that is spearheading the efforts against Measure 4. But I would encourage everybody not only to go to Keep It Local, but go to the opponents too. And then the easiest one is go to your local elected official and say, what would you do? Or if you weren't having the ability to tax on property, what would be your idea? Quite frankly, go to as many people as you can to talk about it. You know, even talk amongst your buddies. Everybody who's owned property knows that there are services necessary for that property. So how are you going to fund it? You can always call me, give me an email. I'm more than happy to kind of walk you through what the data is. But go to as many places as you can.
Aaron, as we wrap it up, another question the proponents of the measure said is, hey, look, our legislature doesn't even understand North Dakota's property tax system. It is too complex. You don't understand it. I don't understand it. They don't understand it. So we got to do something different. Again, how would you respond to that as we wrap things up today?
Well, property tax is complicated. I don't disagree. And I understand there's a lot of people that don't understand it. Sales tax is extremely hard to understand because you just pay for something and it just magically then comes out of whatever you pay for. All taxes can be tough to figure out. At the bottom line for me, though, is what do property taxes pay for? And property tax pays for, in Bismarck, a local teacher that's down the street from me, a local deputy that's down the street from me, and the street in front of me. It's not going to Fargo to pay for their street and their deputy. So property taxes, whether they're too high or too low, you can make those arguments, but there is no doubt they pay for stuff in your community. And I guess if you're going to tax somebody, about the best thing you can do is make sure that money at least stays local so you benefit from that tax. Once you move up the food chain, whether you go to a state tax or a federal tax, now you're taking it from other places and maybe shifting it somewhere else that you're not seeing the benefit. And that's why we think property taxes, even as complicated as it can be, is still benefiting your local community. So we hope that a version of property tax always is there to pay for those essential services.
Aaron Burse has been my guest. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Association of Counties. He's been speaking in opposition to Measure 4 on this November's ballot. Aaron, it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Anytime, Craig. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. Coming up on Main Street, we'll figure out what we should do to correct a mistake we made in last month's Philosophical Currents discussion. We got it wrong when we were talking about Devil's Advocate. What should we do now? Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein helps us along. What a man, what a man. There's our walk-up music for Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's our Philosophical Currents man once a month here on Main Street. Dr. Weinstein is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Oh, I am happy to be here and jazzed to hear the good music.
Last month, we were talking about devil's advocate. And in the context of our conversation, you were talking about that it had to do with the election of a pope in the Catholic Church. A listener called us from Bismarck and said, you know what? You got that wrong. It doesn't have anything to do with the selection of a pope, she said. It has to do with the term is used in the canonization process of the Catholic Church. So we thought today's topic would be good to be being wrong and exploring the nature of human fallibility, examining why we make mistakes, how we can learn from them, and the ethical implications of embracing error. So Jack, you promised that you would do a little research on what a devil's advocate is. What did you learn?
Yeah, so basically, we were talking about sharing different perspectives, and we were talking about learning different things about different people. And what I said was a story that I had heard and actually said many, many times, which is that when they're electing the Pope, when all is said and done, they invite someone to come up to give all the negative things that you can about the Pope, and they call that the devil's advocate. That's where the phrase comes from. But I got it wrong. It actually wasn't for the Pope. It was for the canonization. Famously, Christopher Hitchens, a very famous atheist, was the devil's advocate for the Mother Teresa canonization. And so they really pulled out all of the stops to get negative comments to make sure that if they canonize someone, they canonize the right person for the right reasons, and that someone isn't going to come along and say, poof, here's things you didn't know. So yeah, I got it wrong. And the experience of being a teacher, of being on the radio, of being a public figure, is that we get things wrong all of the time. We remember incorrectly. We don't quite know where we learned things. We just trust that we learned them somewhere, things evolve over time. And I think that there's a difference between the little wrongs and the big wrongs. I mean, I did make a mistake and said it was the Pope when it was the canonization of the saints, but I didn't get it so wrong that I thought it was a Buddhist activity or that it had nothing to do with religion. It's not like I confused the New York Yankees and the Minnesota Twins or anything like that, right? It wasn't a big wrong. It was a little wrong. But those right. little wrongs sometimes can sting, because they make you doubt yourself. They are a little embarrassing. They knock you off kilter and make you ask, well, if I get this wrong, what if I get all the other things wrong too? It knocks us down and knocks our certainty down. And that can be negative, but it also can be positive. It's negative because, again, it's embarrassing and people rely on us and we can send people on wild goose chases because of it. But it's also positive because learning comes from making mistakes. We learn infinitely more from being wrong than we do from being right.
Jack, how do philosophers explain why humans are prone to making mistakes?
This is actually a deep and interesting conversation that has gone on for thousands of years. What causes error? And there isn't a lot of really convincing modern neuropsychology that philosophers have delved into. The basic idea is there is this world of truth out there. There is this world of facts, and that human beings have limited access to that. Think for a second of just, I'm looking around, I'm looking at what's in front of me, and I see a computer or monitor in front of me, right? When I look at the computer monitor, I see the front. I see glass. I see a bezel around it. I see a little blue light that tells me that it's on. But I don't see the back. I don't see the sides. I don't see the insides. I don't see the electronics. I don't see the chemicals that make up the whatever is going on in the screen. I don't see any of that stuff. I just see things on the surface that are visible to me. And so when somebody asks, what does a monitor look like? Even when I'm saying something that's right, it's so incomplete that it may not at all be what they want to hear. Maybe they want to hear that a monitor is a three-dimensional object that is a certain amount of weight, that is a certain amount of thinness, that operates electronically using this kind of switch and this kind of microprocessor and all those sorts of things. So the very first source of error is the fact that our knowledge is so limited that even when we're confident that we can see, hear, smell, touch, or taste something, we are only getting a tiny piece of it.
We remember that from the police stories we hear that where I'm going to line up 10 people to watch something, and then I'm going to bring them into the room and I get 10 different stories of what we just saw. Why is that?
Human memory is incredibly fallible. Human memory associates the things with what people are regard as important personally, as opposed to what's important objectively. So if I notice someone's mustache, maybe that's because I have a mustache. Or if I am noticing someone's shirt, maybe it reminds me of my father's shirt. And then that shirt melds in my mind. And so now I think the person in the lineup was wearing a blue shirt rather than a red shirt or something like that. Our memory works in a variety of ways, associating things with other things. So it's not just that I think about a pen. I think about what the meaning of the pen is. I think about when I bought the pen. I think about the pen as whether it writes or doesn't write well. There is no such thing as a piece of information that is decontextualized in our brain. There's no such thing as a piece of information that floats there unconnected. Is that there is a distinction between what philosophers call brain and what philosophers call mind. I think we've talked about this before together, where brain is the meat. Brain is the physical stuff. Brain is the neurology, the chemicals, the electrons, the synapses, these sorts of things. But then there's this mysterious thing called mind. And mind is what you get when you combine it all. And that's the experience of consciousness, the experience of remembering, of knowing who you are, of being Craig in the world, surrounded by the world. And no one has been able to give a good account of what that consciousness is. Philosophers have disagreed all of philosophy as to what constitute minds, what the limits of mind is. Can we meditate and access a greater world? What happens when we have a eureka moment, a revelation? Is that access to something other than ourselves, or is it access to something into ourselves? Part of the reason why error or mistakes are so complicated is that our very thinking and the way we exist in the world as thinking beings is incredibly complicated, and no one has been able to give a definitive account of how that works, either physiologically or psychologically.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Today's topic is being wrong, exploring the nature of human fallibility and examining why we make mistakes, how we can learn from them, and the ethical implications of embracing error. Jack, why do some humans struggle to admit when they are wrong, and what role does humility play in acknowledging and correcting our mistakes?
Some people are more insecure than others. And when you are insecure and you make a mistake, it makes you feel vulnerable. You're vulnerable to criticism. You're vulnerable to laughter. You're vulnerable to attacks of certain kind. And you see this a lot in front of a classroom. There are professors who, no matter what they don't know, they will never say that they don't know what they're talking about. That if a student asks them a question and they don't know the answer, they'll use all sorts of big language and technical terms and all of that sort of stuff to obfuscate, to hide the fact that they don't know what they're talking about. The best professors that I've always experienced, the best professors that I have, and the person that I try to be, is the professor that when asked a question, say, I don't know. I'll look into that. Often I'll say, look, I'm not really sure, but my best guess is, or this is the first time I'm thinking about it. So my instinct is this, that, and the other thing, but I might be wrong. So the very first thing is that error makes us feel insecure and vulnerable and makes us feel like someone can attack us and knock us down a peg. That has to do with our psychology. That has to do with how we were born and our character and what our parents were like and how often we were wrong before. There's a world of difference of being someone who is perceived as being right all the time and making a small wrong, and someone who is perceived as not so certain and not so right all the time and making a big wrong and humiliating yourself. I keep talking about these small wrongs, but there are big wrongs too. There's being wrong about choosing your life partner. There's being wrong about maybe choosing or predicting what's going to happen with a political candidate. There's being wrong about choosing the wrong or right profession. There's being wrong about giving someone the wrong medication and really putting their life at risk. One of the things that we have to do when we manage being wrong is we have to contextualize how important are the consequences of being wrong. What's the result? Is it just, oops, I made a mistake, let's change the information? Or are there massive repercussions that have to be dealt with? And when there are, the most important thing is to admit you're wrong right away, because then you can deal with the consequences. If you double down, if you dig your heels in, the consequences can be so much worse.
So essentially, the ethical responsibilities we have when we are wrong is to admit it.
Absolutely right. Our primary ethical responsibility is always to the truth. Now, that makes me sound a little old-fashioned, because there are lots of people that think truth doesn't exist, and we can have a conversation about that if you want. But since the truth exists, and since so many people depend on reality, so many people depend on us and our opinions and what we do, our first and primary responsibility is to admit that we are wrong and to try to access the thing that we needed to find. Years ago, I was very young, I was in my 20s, and I was driving along in a new area in New Jersey, and I made a mistake, and I went straight when I was supposed to go left. There was a big crowd of cars, and all of a sudden, a state trooper came over and pulled me over. And he said, you know, gave me a ticket for violating. And I said, I'm new around here. I made a mistake. I'm sorry. And he said, well, you also don't have your seatbelt on. And I could give you a ticket for that, but I'm not. And I did have my seatbelt on. I had just taken it off to get the stuff out of the glove compartment. And to this day, I am not bothered by the fact that I got that ticket. I made a mistake. I did something stupid. I was a young, experienced driver. I pay the fine. Fine. But the thing that still gets me angry is that when I told the truth, I was disbelieved and I was accused of lying. And that's the flip side of all of this. The flip side of all of this is it's often very painful to be accused of being wrong when you're not. It's often very frustrating and very upsetting to be faced with a certain kind of lack of trust or lack of agency. And that's one of the reasons why it's incredibly important to admit when you are wrong. Because if you admit when you're wrong, then when someone says, I'm not wrong, or please believe me, there's more trust there and there's more reliability there. So when you manipulate the situation or refuse to admit your mistakes, you are not only indicting yourself, you're risking indicting other people who shouldn't be attacked in that way. Truth and falsity, lies and truth-telling are very, very much intertwined, and it's all about trusting, because we don't have the books in front of us. We don't have the evidence in front of us. 99.9% of everything we know because we were told by someone else. We read it through someone else. I have never experienced the Nile River, but lots of people tell me it's there. And so I assume that they're telling the truth. I have never been to the moon. I've actually never been to Dickinson, believe it or not.
Really?
I have never been to Dickinson. I've driven past it, but I've never stopped in. And that makes me feel very guilty. So I apologize to all the Dickinsonians. But I trust that Dickinson is there. I trust and here's where I could get myself in trouble again. If I remember correctly, Dickinson is dominated by a big Walmart on a hill. And that's my vision of what I would see if I'm in Dickinson. Now, if I'm right, and all those people that told me those things were telling the truth, then I know something about Dickinson. If I remember incorrectly, now everyone listening to Prairie Public is once again going to say, oh, Jack got it wrong. What does that do for my credibility? All of this is to say, the vast majority of knowledge that we get from other people or from people who have done other things. And if we can't trust people from saying something is true when it is and something is false when it is, there is a domino effect that makes us doubt all knowledge. And that's part of what's going on these days. Part of what's going on these days is that our public officials are absolutely unwilling to admit when they made a mistake or unwilling to admit when they were wrong. And so we've stopped believing all of them wholesale, because how can we trust them if they're not even able to say, oh, hey, I misspoke, or I said this thing wrong, or I didn't know what I was talking about.
So it's the concept of willful negligence, really, that they are on purpose promulgating something that's false, something that is just not right, maybe for their own agenda or their own benefit.
I think you're right. I really like the phrase willful negligence here, because what it highlights is the fact that we are choosing our reaction to being wrong. Our reaction to being wrong is entirely within our control. Now, we may feel embarrassed and we may you know, go over it in our head over and over again and then sort of hold on to it if that's on, in our personality. But how we feel and how we act are two very, very different things. And so if we knowingly and willingly dig our heels in and refuse to admit we're wrong when either we know we are or we know we could be, then we are indeed engaged in a kind of willful negligence, and negligence harms other people. It isn't just about ourselves. Being wrong harms other people, and our job is to find the truth and try to get to be as right as possible. The person who called in to tell me that I was wrong about the devil's advocate thing, you could hear in her voice that she took it very seriously, that she wanted me to go on the air. She didn't say the word recant. I can't remember what phrase she uses, but basically she wanted me to retract. Come on the air, retract, right? Thank you. She wanted me to come on the air and retract, and I'm happy to do so, in part because clearly getting this piece of information wrong upset her, that she felt that somehow I misrepresented the Catholic Church. And that's, of course, the last thing that I wanted to. So even in this one instance, were I to say, let's ignore it. Nobody's going to remember the interview. It's only one person who called. What's the difference? I'd still be hurting that one person who, I don't want to go so far as say her feelings were hurt because I don't know the situation at all, but she cared enough to call. It was important enough for her to make the phone call, to leave the message, to make sure that I and other listeners knew the truth. And if it's important enough for her to make all of those efforts, it has to be important enough for me to respond appropriately, do the research, make sure she was correct, and of course she was, and then come on the air and show at minimum that I respect our listeners enough to respond to their needs.
You work with young people every day. What's done or what should be done to create a culture, I guess, that embraces error? You talked about it earlier as a learning opportunity rather than a source of shame. And I ask that in this world of bullies and bullying.
I think the key is to create something that has gotten a lot of bad press in the last 5 or 10 years, and that's what we'll call a safe space. My classroom is a safe space because if somebody gets something wrong, we're not going to laugh at them. My classroom is a safe space because people, the students have the opportunity to experiment, to try new things, to try a new identity on, to try a new idea, raises their hand and says, hey, they call me Jack. Hey, Jack, I was thinking about this the other day. What would you think about X, Y, and Z? And I listen, and I give my honest response, and the other students listen. No one's allowed to call anyone stupid. No one's allowed to laugh at anyone unless they make a joke, right? No one's allowed to ridicule someone. It is my responsibility in the classroom to create an environment where people are safe and can make mistakes without consequences. What happens in the classroom should stay in the classroom in that sense. Now, that doesn't mean that anyone can say anything or anyone can do anything, but if someone is legitimately trying to work something out, even if it's controversial, even if it's unsettling, then it's up to us in an environment to really put that on the table. Now, I have an incredible advantage as a philosophy professor because as a philosopher, I can talk about anything. Any topic is on the table. If I were a chemist and teaching a chemistry class, then the question of ethics or question of social and political issues or politics might not be appropriate. If I'm talking about a chemical reaction of two, you know, I don't know, substances, and someone raises their hand and says, hey, a politician said this thing the other day, let's talk about it, I'm completely within my rights to say, this is a chemistry class. You know, sir, this is a Wendy's, right? This is a chemistry class. We can't talk about that right now. But if it's even tangentially related to something that we're talking about in class, as a philosopher, I have free rein to pull that thread and go wherever it goes. So I don't mean to suggest that every teacher in every classroom has a responsibility to address every idea. But what I will say is that if the idea is pertinent to what you're doing, then it is your job as the leader, your job as the teacher, your job as the person, the role model, to show off the best way to deal with being right, being wrong, being unsure, being investigatory and curious, because that's the other thing. In a bullying environment like you're describing, in an environment where people aren't allowed to be wrong or aren't allowed to be uncertain, there can be no curiosity. Curiosity indicates the fact that we don't know something. If I'm curious about something, it means I want to know more about it. I want to learn additional things. And so there can't be curiosity without error, and there can't be curiosity without safety.
We host Philosophical Currents once a month here on Main Street with our good friend, what a man, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and I just keep thinking about the song that you're playing, You Get What You Wish For.
It's with you forever now, at least while I'm here. More Main Street's ahead after this. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's
relaxed with pep. The Bush Foundation is accepting applications for the 2025 Bush Fellowship, now through October 15. The fellowship is an investment in the people leading change in our region so they can create bigger change in their communities. 30 fellows will be selected and receive $150,000 to grow their capacity, knowledge, and networks to lead. Learn more about how to apply for the Bush Fellowship at bushfoundation.org/bush-fellows.
This is Dakota Daybook for October 1st. October is Archives Month, a time to recognize the efforts to assess, collect, organize, preserve, and provide access to information of lasting value. The North Dakota State Archives is part of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. In the early morning of Sunday, December 28, 1930, the North Dakota State Capitol burned down. People capture this historic and momentous event on film and in photos. Newspapers across the state reported on it. Matilda Town Rupp, who grew up in Bismarck, was born in 1927. Although very young at the time, she remembered the event when interviewed by state archives staff in 2017. She said, "When the Capitol burned down, my mother drove my brother and me up to the beginning of the driveways. And I can still see that brick building and something about the building coming down. After they returned home, they continued to watch the fire from the roof of their house. The State Historical Society in Bismarck experienced its own unique situation due to the fire. Luckily, its offices and historical collections had recently moved from the basement of the Capitol building into the Liberty Memorial building across the street. Librarian Florence Davis reported that the Historical Society had gotten most of the move completed by the evening of December 27th, just hours before the fire. This included clearing a section of the basement, nicknamed the Pit, an outstanding achievement because, in her words, it had accumulated such a conglomerate of storage from both the Memorial Building and the Old Capitol. After the fire, the Board of Administration sent a delegation to the Historical Society requesting offices and space with vaults for some of the state agencies, a challenge that disrupted normal operations and took away spaces they had just arranged. Documents, photos, and even some film of the Capitol burning can be viewed by contacting the North Dakota State Archives. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, the participants in the vice presidential debate, are both Midwesterners and both veterans.
Everybody has a responsibility to contribute. For me, it was serving in the Army National Guard.
I enlisted in the United States Marines.
Which one is most ready for service now? Analysis on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow we have a packed show. You'll hear about an upcoming speaker series from Humanities North Dakota. We'll learn about the 4th annual Black Elk Forum that will be held at the University of Mary, and another edition of Prairie Plates. That's all tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.